Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 112, and it's Thursday, March 1st, 2012. And at the moment, I don't have a co-host, although if you notice any background noise today, I have the windows open and I have the doors open and everything because I'm pre-recording this actually on Wednesday afternoon for Thursday. And here in Western Ohio, it's like 70 degrees and the last day of February and it's like 70 degrees. So weird. So you may have some road noises, or there may be some, if the dogs start barking, they're going to be really loud. As usual, Nikki the dog or Baggy the cat may choose to join me at any particular moment. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about today, I want to go back to some of the stuff that I was talking about yesterday and cover some of the things I didn't really get to touch on. So yesterday I was talking about logical arguments. Yeah, like somebody's out on their Harley. Oh, man. Okay, so yesterday I was talking about logical arguments, recognizing propaganda, messing with trolls, how to draw logical conclusions and not fall for logical fallacies, and what some of the actual terminology in formal rhetoric, what some of it is and what it's called and so forth, and how to recognize it. And I left with the ad hominem argument. And that literally means to the man, which is an indication that you are putting the argument not towards the topic or not towards the logic, but towards the person presenting the argument. In the case of the internet, it's where the argument, well, the sun is made of a fish. No, the sun is not made of a fish. The sun is made of, and then it gets to the point of where the person says, okay, you know what? You think the sun is made of a fish. You're an idiot. Now, at the point that you begin that, then you have diverted away from a logical argument, and you've taken on a personal attack. That is ad hominem. That's to the man. And there are times that I will leap to that right off the bat, because if I recognize that it's a troll, or I recognize that it's someone that I have absolutely no desire to speak to, or it's just someone who I know is there strictly just to try to embarrass me or make some kind of a statement of some kind on their own for their own agenda or whatever. And I'm just not a polite person, so I'll just go straight to that and that doesn't necessarily dispute whatever argument that's going on, but it gets them out of my face. So I do tend to use that maybe I overuse ad hominem, to a certain extent, but, if the argument is staying civil, and it is staying, within reason. In other words, someone is presenting their argument and they're presenting evidence for it, and there's a logical working out and trying to develop what the truth really is, then I won't ever go to an ad hominem attack. But as I say, I use that strictly when it's just someone I have no desire to speak to anyway. Okay, so now next I wanted to talk about identifying patterns. Now, identifying patterns is extremely important in everyday life. It's important in the development of what made us what we are today. It's an important part of our mind, and it's very handy to be able to identify patterns. I've talked before about a thing that I used, a method that I used to teach my children when they were small. I would say to them, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, goose, duck, duck, what comes next? Well, goose comes next. How do you know goose comes next? Because you follow the pattern. So by watching that, you can learn a lot of things about people, people's behavior, how to predict the future, predict people's behavior in a way that you can adjust your own behavior accordingly. It's a very useful tool, but you have to be careful, because it's easy to fall into identifying patterns like that as a fallacy. For example, there's a thing called the gambler's fallacy. And the gambler's fallacy is where you are playing, let's say, playing a slot machine, and you keep playing it because you think, oh, this machine hasn't hit in so many tries, and so it's due. Well, that may be the case with some types of machines, but the vast majority of modern gaming machines, they're not even called gambling anymore. Legally, there's a definition. They're not allowed to call it gambling when you play slot machines. They're required to call it gaming because it's not a gamble. It's a guaranteed payout for the casino or whoever owns the gaming machine itself. There's a guaranteed quantity that it's going to pay them, and there's a guaranteed amount it's going to pay out. And it's always guaranteed that it's going to pay them more than it pays you. So it's not even really gambling. But this gambler's fallacy is this idea that a hit is due. So you just keep playing, thinking that at any moment I could hit the big one, I could hit the big one. And of course, that's what the gaming machines are designed to play up on, that fallacy. So they will always feed you small victories, but never as much as what you're putting in. Now, it is possible to occasionally hit a big number on a slot machine. I'm not saying you can't win at a slot machine, but I'm saying that it's a machine that's designed in a specific way so that the casino always makes more than it puts out. But the gambler's fallacy, let's use a simpler thing. Let's take something like dice. Now, dice have no brains. They have no memory. They have no computers controlling them. They have nothing telling them what to do. And as you throw dice, assuming that the dice are not loaded, they're honest dice, the dice don't know what the last throw was, and they don't know what the next throw will be. They don't know anything because they're dice. You see. Now, so when you throw the dice, whatever the odds are, and of course, in a gambling situation, the house, if they're a proper gambling house, they know what the odds are and there are different odds for different combinations. So the house will know that, and the odds that the house establishes for the dice are based on those established odds. But when you throw the dice, there's no such thing as hot dice or cold dice. They don't know who's holding them. They don't know who's throwing them. They don't know who threw the last time. This is the realm of mythology, that the dice have some kind of magic power. So the gambler's fallacy is one that says, well, you know, the coin was just got tossed four times, and it was heads four times in a row. Therefore, it has to be tails next. Well, the same gambler might have the different aspect of the gambler's fallacy. They might be saying, oh, this coin is hot. It's going heads. So it's just flipped four heads in a row. It's going to go another heads. Why is that? Well, because it's hot. It's hot on heads right now. See, that's part of the gambler's fallacy. The coin doesn't know what it landed on last time. The coin doesn't know what it's going to land on next time. The coin doesn't know anything. It's just a piece of metal. So it has no memory. It has no pattern. There is no pattern. It's all made up in your mind. This is the same thing that causes when we look up in the sky and we see an interesting cloud float by and we think it looks like a bunny or a dragon or a aardvark. These things are happening in your mind. They're patterns that you're seeing in your mind that you're forcing onto an inanimate object that really has no pattern. It's why we look up in the night sky. Well, not here in Ohio. We don't really have a night sky in Ohio, but I remember the night sky from when I lived in the desert. It's when you look up in the night sky and you see all these stars, and then you start to see things like, oh, a hunter holding a bow and arrow, or, you know, a scorpion, or all these different shapes that your mind leaps to because your mind wants to see a pattern, so you see the pattern. Now, we can bring this into logic in ways where you can say, let's say you attribute something to a particular political party. You say, oh, well, the Democrats always do this and the Republicans always do that. Therefore, my favorite Democrat, this guy is going to do this because of this pattern that's totally unrelated to anything he's ever done before. The stock market has been doing this and this and this, and therefore I see this pattern developing. And so, and then you jump out and you invest something based on a pattern that you think you see, whether the pattern is really there or not. So that's the identifying fallacy, or what's sometimes called the gambler's fallacy. Now, one that's really easy to fall into, and yet it's one of the best known fallacies, is the bandwagon fallacy. You could also call it the team spirit fallacy. It's the idea that, my favorite brand is better than your favorite brand. Coke versus Pepsi, Chevy versus Dodge. The New England Patriots versus the New York Jets, or whatever. This is attaching blind faith to a particular group or a particular ideology or a particular thought pattern or a particular belief, based squarely on who else believes that or who else supports it. Or, everybody you know is a fan of the Cubs, so you're a fan of the Cubs. Well, that's the bandwagon approach. Now, your mom might attack the bandwagon approach by saying, well, if everybody else was jumping off a cliff, would you do it? And of course, if you're honest with your mom, you probably say, well, maybe. But, we hope not. But on the other hand, this is an aspect of the herd mentality that is very deep set within the human brain. We have a very deep desire to be a part of a group, to be accepted by the group, to behave like the rest of the group, and to accept what the group accepts. And in ways, at times in the past, this has been very productive for human beings, and it's been something that, may have helped us survive for eons of time. But when applied, like many other things that come to us in that same manner, when applied to complicated issues, the bandwagon or the, the mom's bridge argument, just doing it because everybody else is doing it, that can get really dangerous. And you end up just accepting what Fox News tells you because all your friends listen to Fox News. Or you just accept what they say on MSNBC because everybody at your work watches MSNBC all the time. Everybody listens to NPR. So therefore NPR must be the people to listen to. Well, those can get pretty dangerous if you're taking actions based on what the rest of the herd is taking. And if the rest of the herd is wrong, then, back to the herd scenario, you could easily just run off a cliff without realizing it. Now, next, I want to hit sweeping generalities. Sweeping generalities is used really common against libertarians, and it may be the most, next to maybe the straw man argument that I talked about last time, sweeping generalities may be something that libertarians are both the most guilty of and the most accused of at the same time. Sweeping generalities are things like, Republicans tend to think of libertarians as being crazed left-wing drug nuts, and they think, well, if somebody's a libertarian, they're probably a drug user. Well, that's a sweeping generality that's not only totally not accurate, but it's simplifying things to a level that is almost stupid. But then the left will think of libertarians, and they'll get the opposite view. They'll think of us as being, crazed right-wing gun nuts. And of course, that's pretty stupid too, especially when the left wing fancies themselves as the anti-war party, when in fact, they're the ones who tend to start the wars, not even as so much as the right wing does. So the sweeping generalities, when we think about that, that's one of the things Bastiat complained about, like, what, 160 years ago, Bastiat was complaining. He didn't use the phrase sweeping generalities, but he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said something to the effect of, do you know what they accuse us of? When we say there shouldn't be state-funded religion, they claim we're atheists. Or if we say there shouldn't be state-funded school, they claim we're against education. Or when we say there shouldn't be state-funded, the state shouldn't fund the arts, they think we're barbarians that want no art. And that's a, you know, that was Bastiat complaining about sweeping generalities. And in the same sense, Bastiat complained in a different spot about how if we say that the government ought to leave farming alone and not involve itself in farm subsidies and interference in the farming market, then somehow we're against farmers because of this, or perhaps we're against food, or we're against, you know, just because we don't want the government to do it doesn't mean we're not against it. And just because we don't want the government involved doesn't mean we're for it. But that's the sweeping generality that we get poured into. This is the problem that always comes up with gay marriage. The typical libertarian who is consistent in his libertarian ways will say, you know, the government has no business telling us what marriage is or is not. It has nothing to do with whether gay marriage is good or gay marriage is bad, or straight marriage is good or bad, or if marriage itself is good or bad. It has nothing to do with any of those issues. It has to do with the fact that the government has no position, has no right to say one way or the other what is or what is not marriage or have any influence in marriage. And yet, when the left hear us say that, they assume we're for gay marriage. And when the right hear us say that, the left assume that we're against gay marriage because we don't want the government sanctioning it. And yet the right hear us say those same things, and they think we're for gay marriage because we don't want the government outlawing it. Well, you know, if you take the government out of the issue, then whatever a person wants to do, as long as they're not harming somebody else, is not our business. And that's our point. But that's not what we get pushed into. We get pushed into these arguments where we end up having to support something that we may or may not support, or having to deny something that we may or may not want to deny. And rather than that, we need to be able to point out these sweeping generalities and sidestep the argument altogether if possible, and try to lead back to a logical level of understanding what the zero aggression principle is and getting back to that rather than just focusing on what this person's preconceived notions are and what shelf they want to set us on, or what category they want to stick us into. Now, and another one is the argument by innuendo. Now, I like this one. This is particularly fun to use on a troll, because as the troll, once you recognize the troll is not there for a honest and peaceful exchange of information, they're just there to cause trouble, then it's fun to use this argument on the troll. So you can use the argument by innuendo by saying something like, you know, it's the old one, do you still beat your wife? That question, where you're not saying they beat their wife, but you're allowing that in the conversation in a way that infers that they did. So another way to do an argument by innuendo is to say, well, you know, I never actually caught Bill stealing anything from the cash drawer. So in that sentence, I never actually caught Bill stealing anything from the cash drawer. What you're actually saying is, you're putting it in the listener's mind that perhaps Bill steals, maybe even from the cash drawer. We've just never caught him. So you've placed that, into their heads without actually saying that Bill is a thief. You've put that seed into their mind that Bill is indeed a thief. And how can Bill respond to this? Well, of course I didn't steal from the cash drawer. Well, I'm not saying you did, Bill. See, as a matter of fact, Bill, I said I've never caught you stealing from the cash drawer. You see, you leave yourself a plausible deniability in doing this. So as you learn the technique and play around with it, it's a fun way to anger trolls. But it's also something that can be used against you. And so you need to recognize it and realize that what they're doing is they're setting up a false dichotomy where they're asking you to choose for yourself between two false choices. So whenever you're offered a false dichotomy or whenever you're offered an argument by innuendo like this, and that's a little different from a false dichotomy, but they can often be used in conjunction with each other. When this happens, the best thing to do is just to step away from that altogether and realize that that's just being used to set you up. It's not being used in any kind of an honest manner at all. Because if they had any kind of honest accusation, then they could make that accusation and you could answer it. But by using this innuendo like that, they're making the accusation while providing for themselves a plausible deniability in the argument. So they can always go back and say, well, I didn't say you stole that. Now, another one that I like to play around with is called the abusive accent. And when I think of this one, I think of that wonderful movie, My Cousin Vinny, that had Joe Pesci in his comedic role. And I think it was Ralph Macchio played the nephew, if I recall. And the nephew is accused of robbing a convenience store and killing the clerk and then fleeing. And of course, he's totally innocent. It was different people that had a slight resemblance to the accused. But the character is arrested and he's being questioned by the cop. And the cop is asking him, the cop says something to the effect of, and this is not word for word from the scripts, but you'll get the idea. The cop says something like, now, so you were in the convenience store. And the guy's like, yeah, I was in the convenience store. Now, what were you doing in the convenience store? Well, I was getting a can of tuna. So you were picking up a can of tuna and you were holding that can of tuna? Yeah, I was holding the can of tuna. Now, is that when you shot the clerk? And his response is, I shot the clerk? And then it goes to court, and the cop is reading the manuscript from the questioning. And he says, so I asked the defendant, was that the moment when you shot the clerk? And his response was, I shot the clerk. Now, this is not necessarily accent, but it falls within the definition of abusive accent. It's actually a fluctuation in the vocal presentation being the difference between a question and a positive statement. So the accused, when he was being questioned, and the cop said, is that when you shot the clerk? And he's like, I shot the clerk? But when it goes to court and the guy reads it, it is no longer a question. It becomes a confession. I shot the clerk. I shot the clerk? I shot the clerk. So now the obvious lesson here is don't talk to a cop, period. If you're pulled over, there's basic questions, basic answers. You have your license, your registration. If he engages you in questions like, do you know why I pulled you over? Do not attempt to give him an answer. Just be as minimalist as possible. Be as polite as possible. Give as little information as possible. Make the event as short and as sweet as possible. And, you know, the least amount of time you are talking to a cop, the safer you are. If, on the other hand, you begin giving unnecessary information to a cop, it's his job to do something with that information. And if the cop will give you as much rope as you want to take in order to hang yourself, and he'll twist it because he may not even do it intentionally. But the fact is that once these things, once you say them and you don't have the facial expressions and you don't have the influxes in your voice and you don't have all these things defining what it is you're talking about, and that stuff gets transmitted to a jury later on or transmitted to a district attorney later on, then it can sound really bad. Now, attorneys are trained to know how to spot that kind of thing. So if you insist upon talking to a cop, have your attorney present and make it clear that you are going to speak to the cop through the attorney. Let the attorney do the talking for you. That's what they're there for. Honestly, you know, attorneys are expensive, and I know all the lawyer jokes. I've told many lawyer jokes, including telling lawyer jokes to my own lawyers. But I'm telling you something, you know, let them do their job. Now, that may not be, you know, there's a lot of focus right now on never taking a plea, never take a plea bargain. And as much as possible, I would be in that camp as much as possible. But keep, you know, logical limits on everything that you're doing here. But either way, having an attorney present during any questioning, and don't fall for the thing that, well, they haven't read me my rights. It doesn't matter. Maybe that mattered at one point in time, but today in 2012, it doesn't matter. If you're being questioned by a cop, you better have an attorney, or else you better figure out a way to get out of the questioning as quick as possible without telling them anything. Because anything you say, they can and they will twist it and use it against you if you speak to them. So it's better just to not do that. Now, I have a little bit of a personal experience with this, and it's very similar to the My Cousin Vinny situation. Once, when I was I was still a teenager, I was picked up by the police and accused of stealing a newspaper machine. You know, one of these machines that sits next to a business, and you drop quarters into it, and the front opens, and you pull out a newspaper. Well, I was accused of stealing, I don't know if it was one or multiple. I'm not sure exactly which I was accused of stealing, if it was just a single machine or if it was a multiple machine. I'm not sure. Anyway, I may have known back then, but that's been, you know, 35 years ago or whatever. Anyway, I was accused of this. And the funny part is that I was working construction at the time, and I would work 3 or 4 days a week in construction. And in the particular type of construction I was doing was underground utilities installation. So I would pull up with my company's truck and their ditch digger on the back of the truck. I would back the ditcher off of the back of the truck, pull it over to the plot lot of where they were going to do the construction, and I would dig in all the utilities. It would take me about an hour and a half to 2 hours from the time I pulled onto the property till the time I was pulling the truck away with the ditcher loaded back up. Was anywhere hour and a half to 2 hours, maybe 3 hours if it was a big project. And I'm earning anywhere from $100 to $300 for that couple hours work. And so the cops pull me in and they start asking me about stealing a newspaper machine. And I'm blowing it off. It's like, this is stupid. Why are you asking? This is crazy. And I made the statement that, you know, how much could you get out of a newspaper machine? I mean, you know, if you broke one of those things open, you probably couldn't get enough to buy a hamburger out of one of them. Now, once that got to the district, the cop I was talking to wasn't even writing anything down. Okay. And yet there's a transcript of this that goes to the district attorney. And on the transcript, it says that I said that I didn't get enough out of the machine to buy a hamburger. And so, of course, he's reading this transcript. And of course, he decides to issue a warrant. And they decide to try to press charges on me. Now, of course, I beat the thing. I did actually go get a lawyer. There was a sworn affidavit that was made by the shopkeeper that said that, in fact, I didn't in any way resemble the person. He couldn't identify me in any way as the person who took the thing. The vehicle didn't match the description of my vehicle. And it was a whole thing. But the lawyer had to take care of all this stuff. And then the whole thing was dropped and it was all tossed anyway. But my point in that being is that I was silly enough that I had nothing to hide. Why should I hide anything? And so in casual conversation, the cop says to me, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how much could you get out of one of those things? And that turned into the district attorney putting on a warrant for me. Now, I think it's about time we break for our commercial. And so be sure and stick with us through the commercial, listen to the commercial, and come out on the other side. The commercial's not that long, really. Really, stick with it, listen to it, and I'll be right back. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, so back from the commercial. And I do want to thank the guys at Shire Silver and Kelly over at Survival Gear Bags for allowing us to have their commercials on and for sponsoring the show. It's really nice of them. Be sure and get over there to BadQuaker.com and click on the links and look around and see if there isn't something you'd like to have from either Shire Silver or Survival Gear Bags. And I told you, that they went into the commercial was there, and then I go on with the commercial anyway. That's not very fair. I do want to wrap up the thing with rhetoric, though, because really that's only half the show. So I want to wrap that up by just saying that when you're talking about these things, and I did in the first podcast that I was talking about this, I talked about creating controlled scenarios and how the guy with the Zeitgeist film was trying to do that, but he was creating a scenario where he was assuming his initial point and then forcing the logic around what he wanted to prove. But it's a legitimate method to try to create a controlled scenario and then bump your principle up against that to see if your principle is sound or not. And so I think I used the example of the apple grower and the taco stand person. I like to use the apples and the tacos whenever possible because they're nice and simple and everything. Murray Rothbard trying to explain this in his book, which one was it? I'm not sure, so I shouldn't say. Man, Economy, and State. No, that's what it was. I'm pretty sure it was in Man, Economy, and State. Not Man, Economy, State, although a Man, Economy, State would be much better than the state we have. But in Murray Rothbard's book, Man, Economy, and State. And Murray goes through and explains a very similar thing to what I was talking about with the apples and the tacos, and how trade is truly a voluntary, when trade is truly voluntary, when the exchange is voluntary, then both parties profit from it. Except Murray, you know, it was old, and he was from a different generation, and so he gives the explanation of workhorses and barrels of fish. So I think my apples and tacos are a little bit easier to listen to than hearing Murray rambling on about draft horses and you know, barrels of fish. But anyway, so it's entirely legitimate to create scenarios like that and then bump your theory or bump your principle across that scenario to see if it works. But it's just important to follow the rules of logic as you're doing that, so that you don't try to fool yourself, so that you have present an honest argument to yourself. And when you're presenting an argument to someone else, of course, you want to present as honest an argument as possible, so that you don't look like a fool when they tear it apart, you know. And of course, the prime reason being that if we seek the truth on all these things, then in the long run, we're all going to be better off, whether we're right or whether we're wrong. If we're seeking the truth, then eventually we're going to reach a better position than we were in before. Now, I want to jump back a little bit. I'm not really giving a commercial here for Shire Silver, but I did want to mention it. I was very thrilled. A friend of mine who has a podcast, and was a great inspiration for me to get this podcast going, a guy named Jack Spearco. Jack was up recently in New Hampshire at the Liberty Forum up there, and I really wanted to go to the Liberty Forum, but it just didn't work out this year. And we really were trying to shuffle things around and get to Pork Fest in New Hampshire. That's the Porcupine Festival they have every summer, and I'm really hoping that we can get the motorhome and make a trip up there, and maybe even set up and have some podcasting there from Porkfest. That would really be great. I don't know if we're going to be able to do that or not, but there are a lot of circumstances. But it's something that we, all of us here, have talked about, and we would really like to make that happen. But hearing Jack talk about his experiences and going up to New Hampshire, and he got to meet the folks from Shire Silver, and he got to see firsthand the little cards with the laminated strips of metal in there. And it was really refreshing. You know, there was a time some time back that quite a few of us tried to get Jack's attention and get him to see those laminated cards and understand about them. And it was kind of a wasted experience. But now that Jack has actually seen them, he's quite impressed. And I was really happy with that he's come on board with that. That's a situation where a person jumps to a conclusion before they hear the whole thing, and then they hold to that conclusion that they have grasped, and they refuse any new information, no matter how contrary it is to what they've already accepted. But fortunately, we've broken through, and once Jack has seen the actual cards from Shire Silver, he has a completely different opinion about them. So that's really good. I was glad to hear that. And I was glad to hear some of the other things that went on at the Liberty Forum, that it was a very successful event, and the weather was relatively kind. That, you know, New Hampshire winters, February in New Hampshire can get a little harsh, but this year was the weather was very cooperative. So that was good to hear, and I was very happy to hear that the people up there in the Free State Project have touched so many people and have changed the outlook of so many people. And you know, I remember just a couple of years ago, there were a few of us. I'm not in the Free State Project. I'm not in New Hampshire, but I've followed along for years as they've gone through this process. And I've been a sort of a distant fan of that whole thing for a long time. So it's really nice to see that it's starting to take off and people are outside of the little circle. People are starting to notice it and hear about it and really starting to respond well to it. I'm very glad of that. You know, for Jack, hey, it's about time, buddy. You know, we've been saying this for a while. You know, it's about time you get with the program. I say that as a friend. You know, Jack knows I'll hassle him and tease him, and he and I clash on some things, but overall, he's my friend, and I like him. And so, now to get on to something a little different. Here's a fun story that popped up this week that I wanted to touch on. This is from, who did this? The Columbus Dispatch from Columbus, Ohio. The Columbus Dispatch, and the headline says, "Secret compartments could get drivers busted." A hidden compartment in your vehicle with or without drugs could mean big trouble as Ohio officials get serious about slowing down drug smuggling. A proposed state law advocated by Governor John Kasinich would make it a fourth-degree felony to own a vehicle equipped with secret compartments. Conviction could mean up to 18 months in jail and a potential $5,000 fine. The hidden compartment law, coupled with nearly 150 new highway signs warning traffickers that they face prison time in Ohio, is part of a stepped-up drug interdiction campaign announced by Kasinich. Well, yay! Aren't we so lucky here in Ohio to have a creep like Kasinich up there in Columbus, spending tax dollars in such a stupid way? So essentially what they're talking about here is, first off, so much of the laws all over the United States are written in such vague terms that they can pretty much be translated any way that the prosecutor wants at that particular time. So for example, in Ohio, I wanted to find out, again, a lot of background noise here. I wanted to find out what exactly what the laws were for carrying a knife. And this has been a couple years back. So I started digging around trying to find out what the laws were in Ohio for carrying a knife, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, I wasn't going to, if I was carrying the wrong knife and some cop found out about it, if it could just mean me adjusting which knife that I was carrying, then, you know, if that will prevent a potential problem, then that's what I would do. The problem is the way the law, unless they've changed it in the last couple of years, the way the law is written in Ohio, it doesn't say knife. It says weapon. So, for instance, if you're carrying something, anything that the cop sees and decides is a weapon, whether it's hidden, you have it in your pocket and it's concealed, or whether you're brandishing it, all these are arbitrary definitions and up to the cop at the time that he particularly decides whether or not you're brandishing a weapon or just walking with a stick. In Ohio, the actual knife law doesn't exist. A weapon law exists. So pretty much anything that you're carrying that the cop decides is a weapon, then he gets to decide whether or not you're carrying it in a threatening fashion, or whether you're concealing it, or whether you're carrying it in a safe fashion. So what exactly is a weapon? Now it's not a knife. It's anything the cop decides that he wants to call a weapon. All right, so now we have compartments in vehicles. Now, what's considered a hidden compartment? If it's built in by the manufacturer, or if it's put in intentionally by a secondary company, like, a stereo company that installs new speakers, and there happens to be a void in the speaker box that perhaps somebody could consider a hidden compartment. Even if you don't know about that, if the cop finds it as he's searching your vehicle, it's pretty much arbitrary on how the cop wants to handle the situation. If he wants to say that you have a secret compartment in your vehicle. And of course, this is going to go hand in hand with the confiscation laws, so that in the long run, what it really means is that the local cops are going to be, they're going to have an incentive to find hidden compartments in vehicles so that they can confiscate them and sell them in their local auctions and make more money for their local police force. That's not necessarily a wild-eyed accusation. That's just how the thing works. And even if it doesn't start out being like that, it will be within a reasonable amount of time. That's the logical process of moving towards that, even if it's not there already. And so, and now again, if the cop gets to decide at the moment what is and what isn't a concealed space, and if he can choose what is and what isn't a weapon, and what is and what isn't concealment, and what isn't brandishing, then law itself becomes an arbitrary thing that can just be enforced upon you in any particular way that they want at any particular time that they want. Actual law itself becomes useless and without any real point. Well, that's what we're moving forward towards one way or the other, isn't it? I mean, that's what the state provides. The state provides a vague set of rules that you're supposed to abide by, even though the rules are so complicated and there's so many rules, there's no possible way you could know them all. And yet you're expected to obey all these rules. On the other hand, there are people in society, politicians, police, certain favored individuals who don't have to follow by these rules. And it all depends on who you know and who you are and this kind of thing. So that, one person can commit horrible crimes and rob from lots of people and they end up getting a smack on the hand. Well, someone else does a very minor thing and they end up in jail for, exaggerated amounts of time over some minor thing where there was no actual victim of a crime. And of course, that's the inevitability of having a police state. And the police state, as I've said in my podcast on the series, having a police state is the inevitable product of allowing there to be police at all. Now, here's a different story for us. It's almost as amazingly comical, if it wasn't for the fact that these goons are actually in charge of things. This comes to us from Yahoo News, and it says, the headline is, U.S. announces diplomatic breakthrough with North Korea. And what is this diplomatic breakthrough? Well, what do you know? The North Koreans are going to allow the nuclear inspectors to go back in and do their tests and look around and poke around in North Korea. And in return, the U.S. government is dumping a huge aid package onto the North Korean government. Now, it's not like this has never happened before. This is the way it always happens. North Korea, for years and years and years, has done this. Their socialist economy is not self-supporting because it's socialism, and socialism always causes shortages and overproduction at the same time. So you can never control a socialist market. And that goes back to Mises and the price mechanism. But anyway, so North Korea has had this problem for years and years. They cannot feed their own nation. They cannot feed their own army. They cannot put a single rifle in the hands of every member of their military. They are an extremely poor country. And so what they do is they rattle the sword. They, get real tough. They talk tough. They pretend like they might be developing some type of atomic weaponry. And then the United States gets tough back with them. And then they reach a compromise, which involves inspectors coming in to show that they really don't have anything going on at all. And the U.S. gives them a huge pile of money. And it repeats this way every couple of years, over and over and over. And of course, the American people never catch on. The only thing the American people ever hear is the half of the argument that goes, oh, that crazy North Korean leader, he's liable to do anything. He could attack Japan. He could attack Hawaii. He could do all these things. And of course, that's lies. North Korea has no method of, even if they had an atomic bomb, which they don't, they have no method of getting it even very much beyond their own international waters, much less to reach somebody like South Korea or Japan or, Hawaii. Really? Hawaii? And somebody will say, oh, but, you know, South Korea could get invaded by North Korea. South Korea is one of the richest, per capita, one of the richest countries in the world. They, if they can't defend themselves against one of the poorest countries in the world, they certainly don't need our help. What they need is maybe to be invaded. I mean, really, if they can't defend themselves, then under what obligation should we go and defend them if they can't defend themselves? But the fact is, they can defend themselves. They're a rich country, and they're fully populated, and they're fully militarized, and they have the capacity to defend themselves against a very weak, very poor country on their northern border. As a matter of fact, if anybody's in danger of anything, it's North Korea is in danger of the culture of South Korea bleeding over that border and the people of North Korea catching on and throwing out their communist government. That's where the real danger lies. But no, you know, the United States enables this horrible, scary boogeyman so that every few years they can drag him back out and scare us with him. And so in this story, that's basically what happens. North Korea agrees, oh yeah, okay, we'll let you come and inspect. And the United States once again decides to dump a massive amount, 240,000 metric tons of food the U.S. is going to ship to them for free. 240,000 metric tons of food that the United States taxpayers are footing the bill for and handing to North Korea. And all that is just so that they will allow their inspectors to go in and say, well, what do you know? North Korea doesn't have a bomb. That's a real shocker, isn't it? And yet, every couple of years, the story repeats itself, and the public never catches on. They constantly believe the lies about North Korea being so aggressive and scary, the boogeyman going to come and get us all. Okay, well, I'm going to have to cut it a little bit short on today's podcast. I've got, you know, I haven't really talked about it. We had a loss in the family last week. A week ago today, this being podcast on Thursday, recorded Wednesday afternoon, a week ago Thursday morning, Kai found that her husband had passed away, and it's really been a devastation to our family. So we are still trying to shuffle things around the house here, and people coming and going, and details having to be taken care of, and so it's pretty much disrupted everything around here. So I do apologize for cutting short on this particular podcast, but I am going to try to get back with Don Meinshausen and finish the second half of his interview, and we'll get that up for you as soon as possible. And Kai's going to take some time off from the podcast, and we're not really sure when or if she'll be coming back, but we do appreciate all the good wishes and everything that came from different people, and both on the website and Facebook and everything else. And I'll just leave you with that, and I'll say, as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much, folks, for all your support.